Chapter 6. Memory believes before knowing remembers, believes longer than recollects, longer than knowing even wonders, knows, remembers, believes a corridor in a big, long, garbled, cold, echoing building of dark red brick, soot bleakened by more chimneys than its own, set in a grassless, cinder-strewn-packed compound, surrounded by smoking factory purlieus and enclosed by a 10-foot steel-and-wire fence like a penitentiary or a zoo, where in random erratic surges with sparrow-like child-troubling orphans in identical and uniform blue denim in and out of remembering, but in knowing, constant as the bleak walls, the bleak windows where in rain, soot from the yearly adjacenting chimneys streaked like black tears. In the quiet and empty corridor, during the quiet hour of early afternoon, he was like a shadow. Small, even for 5 years. Sober and quiet as a shadow. Another in the corridor couldn't have said just when and where he vanished, into what door, what room. But there was no one else in the corridor at this hour. He knew that. He'd been doing this for almost a year, ever since the day when he discovered by accident the toothpaste which the dietitian used. Once in the room, he went directly on his bare and silent feet to the washstand and found the tube. He was watching the pink worm coil smooth and cool and slow onto his parchment-colored finger when he heard footsteps in the corridor and then voices just beyond the door. Perhaps he recognized the dietitian's voice. Anyway, he didn't wait to see if they were going to pass the door or not. With the tube in his hand and still silent as a shadow on his bare feet, he crossed the room and slipped beneath a cloth curtain which screened off one corner of the room. Here, he squatted among delicate shoes and suspended soft woman garments. Crouching, he heard the dietitian and her companion enter the room. The dietitian was nothing to him yet, save a mechanical adjunct to eating, food, the dining room, the ceremony at eating at the wooden forms, coming now and then into his vision without impacting at all, except as something of pleasing association and pleasing in herself to look at. Young, a little full-bodied, smooth, pink and white, making his mind think of the dining room, making his mouth think of something sweet and sticky to eat, and also pink-colored and surreptitious. On that first day, when he discovered the toothpaste in her room, he'd gone directly there, who'd never heard of toothpaste either, as if he already knew that she would possess something of that nature and he would find it. He knew the voice of her companion also. It was that of a young intern from the county hospital who was assistant to the parochial doctor, he too a familiar figure about the house and also not yet an enemy. He was safe now behind the curtain. When they went away, he would replace the toothpaste and also leave. So he squatted behind the curtain, hearing, without listening to it, the women's tense, whispering voice. "No, no. Not here, not now. They'll catch us. Somebody will... No, Charlie. Please." The man's words he couldn't understand at all. The voice was lowered, too. It had a ruthless sound, as the voices of all men did to him, since he was too young yet to escape from the world of women for that brief respite before he escaped back into it to remain until the hour of his death. He heard other sounds, which he did know, a scuffing as of feet, the turn of the key in the door. "No, Charlie. Charlie, please. Please, Charlie," the woman's whisper said. He heard other sounds, rustlings, whisperings, not voices. He wasn't listening, he was just waiting, thinking without particular interest or attention that it was a strange hour to be going to bed. Again the woman's fainting whisper came through the thin curtain. "I'm scared. Hurry, hurry." He squatted among the soft, woman-smelling garments and the shoes. He saw by feel alone now the ruined once cylindrical tube. By taste and not seeing, he contemplated the cool, invisible worm as it coiled onto his finger and smeared sharp, automaton-like and sweet, into his mouth. By ordinary, he would have taken a single mouthful and then replaced the tube and left the room. Even at 5, he knew that he mustn't take more than that. Perhaps it was the animal warning him that more would make him sick. Perhaps the human being warning him that if he took more than that, she'd miss it. This was the first time he'd taken more. By now, hiding and waiting, he'd taken a good deal more. By feel, he could see the diminishing tube. He began to sweat. Then he found that he'd been sweating for some time, that for some time now he'd been doing nothing else but sweating. He wasn't hearing anything at all now. Very likely he wouldn't have heard a gunshot beyond the curtain. He seemed to be turned in upon himself, watching himself sweating, watching himself smear another worm of paste into his mouth, which his stomach didn't want. Sure enough, it refused to go down. Motionless now, utterly contemplative, he seemed to stoop above himself like a chemist in his laboratory waiting. He didn't have to wait long. At once, the paste which he'd already swallowed lifted inside him, trying to get back out into the air where it was cool. It was no longer sweet. In the rife, pink woman-smelling obscurity behind the curtain, he squatted, pink-foamed, listening to his insides, waiting with astonished fatalism for what was about to happen to him. Then it happened. He said to himself with complete and passive surrender, "Well, here I am." When the curtain fled back, he didn't look up. When hands dragged him violently out of his vomit, he didn't resist. He hung from the hands, limp, looking with slack-jawed and glassy idiocy into a face no longer smooth, pink and white, surrounded now by wild and disheveled hair, whose smooth bands once made him think of candy. "You little rat!" the thin, furious voice hissed. "You little rat! Spying on me, you little nigger bastard!" The dietitian was 27. Old enough to have to take a few amorous risks, but still young enough to attach a great deal of importance, not so much to love, but to being caught at it. She was also stupid enough to believe that a child of 5 not only could deduce the truth from what he'd heard, but that he would want to tell it as an adult would. So when, during the following 2 days, she could seem to look nowhere and be nowhere without finding the child watching her with the profound and intent interrogation of an animal, she foisted upon him more of the attributes of an adult. She believed that he not only intended to tell, but that he deferred doing it deliberately in order to make her suffer more. It never occurred to her that he believed that he was the one who had been taken in sin and was being tortured with punishment deferred, and that he was putting himself in her way in order to get it over with, to get his whipping and strike the balance and write it off. By the second day, she was well nigh desperate. She didn't sleep at night. She lay most of the night now, tense, teeth and hands clenched, panting with fury and terror and, worst of all, regret. That blind fury to turn back time just for an hour, a second. This was to the exclusion of even love during the time. The young doctor was now, even less than the child, merely an instrument of her disaster and not even that of her salvation. She couldn't have said which she hated most. She couldn't even say when she was asleep and when she was awake. Because always against her eyelids, or upon her retinae, was that still, grave, inescapable, parchment-colored face watching her. On the third day, She came out of the coma state, the waking sleep through which during the hours of light and faces she carried her own face like an aching mask in a fixed grimace of dissimulation that dared not flag. On the third day, she acted. She had no trouble finding him. He was in the corridor, the empty corridor, during the quiet hour after dinner. He was there, doing nothing at all. Perhaps he'd followed her. No one else could have said if he were waiting there or not. But she found him without surprise, and he heard and turned and saw her without surprise. The two faces, the one no longer smooth, pink and white, the other grave, sober-eyed, perfectly empty of everything except waiting. "Now I'll get it over with," he thought. "Listen," she said. Then she stopped, looking at him. It was as though she couldn't think what to say next. The child waited, still, motionless. Slowly and gradually the muscles of his backside were becoming flat and rigid, as tense as boards. "Are you going to tell?" she said. He didn't answer. He believed that anyone should have known that the last thing in the world he would do would be to tell about the toothpaste, the vomit. He wasn't looking at her face. He was watching her hands, waiting. One of them was clenched inside her skirt pocket. Through the cloth he could see that it was clenched hard. He'd never been struck with a fist, yet neither had he ever waited 3 days to be punished. When he saw the hand emerge from the pocket, he believed that she was about to strike him, but she didn't. The hand just opened beneath his eyes. Upon it lay a silver dollar. Her voice was thin, urgent, whispering, though the corridor was empty about them. "You can buy a lot with this, a whole dollar." He'd never seen a dollar before, though he knew what it was. He looked at it. He wanted it as he would have wanted the bright cap from a beer bottle. But he didn't believe that she would give it to him, because he wouldn't give it to her if it were his. He didn't know what she wanted him to do. He was waiting to get whipped and then be released. Her voice went on, urgent, tense, fast. "A whole dollar, see? How much you could buy? Some to eat every day for a week, and next month maybe I'll give you another one." He didn't move nor speak. He might have been carven, a large toy, small, still, round-headed and round-eyed in overalls. He was still with astonishment, shock, outrage. Looking at the dollar, he seemed to see rank tubes of toothpaste like corded wood, endless and terrifying, his whole being coiled in a rich and passionate revulsion. "I don't want no more," he said. "I don't never want no more," he thought. Then he didn't dare even look at her face. He could feel her, hear her, her long, shuddering breath. "Now it's coming," he thought in a flashing instant. But she didn't even shake him. She just held him, hard, not shaking him, as if her hand, too, didn't know what it wanted to do next. Her face was so near that he could feel her breath on his cheek. He didn't need to look up to know what her face looked like now. "Tell," she said. "Tell, then, you little nigger bastard, you nigger bastard." That was the third day. On the fourth day, she became quite calmly and completely mad. She no longer planned at all. Her subsequent actions followed a kind of divination, as if the days and the unsleeping nights during which she'd nursed behind that calm mask her fear and fury had turned her psychic, along with her natural female infallibility, for the spontaneous comprehension of evil. She was quite calm now. She'd escaped for the moment from even urgency. Now she had time to look about and plan. Looking about the scene, her glance, her mind, her thought went full and straight and instantaneous to the janitor sitting in the door of the furnace room. There was no ratiocination in it, no design. She just seemed to look outside herself for one moment like a passenger in a car, and saw, without any surprise at all, that small, dirty man sitting in a splint chair in a soot-grimed doorway, reading through steel-rimmed spectacles from a book upon his knees. A figure, almost a fixture, of which she'd been aware for 5 years now, without once having actually looked at him. She wouldn't have recognized his face on the street. She would have passed him without knowing him, even though he was a man. Her life now seemed straight and simple as a corridor with him sitting at the end of it. She went to him at once, already in motion upon the dingy path, before she was aware that she'd started. He was sitting in his splint chair in the doorway, the open book upon his knees. When she approached, she saw that it was the Bible. But she just noticed this, as she might have noticed a fly upon his leg. "You hate him, too," she said. "You've been watching him, too. I've seen you. Don't say you don't." He looked up at her face, the spectacles propped now above his brows. He wasn't an old man. In his present occupation, he was an incongruity. He was a hard man, in his prime, a man who should have been living a hard and active life, and whom time, circumstance, something, had betrayed, sweeping the hale body and thinking of a man of 45 into a backwater suitable for a man of 60 or 65. "You know," she said. "You knew before the other children started calling him nigger. You came out here at the same time. You weren't working here a month before that Christmas night when Charlie found him on the doorstep yonder. Tell me." The janitor's face was round, a little flabby, quite dirty with a dirty stubble. His eyes were quite clear, quite gray, quite cold. They were quite mad, too. But the woman didn't notice that. Or perhaps they didn't look mad to her. So they faced one another in the coal-grimed doorway, mad eyes looking into mad eyes, mad voice talking to mad voice, as calm and quiet and terse as two conspirators. "I've watched you for 5 years." She believed that she was telling the truth, sitting here in this very chair watching him. "You never sit here except when the children are outdoors, but as soon as they come out, you bring this chair here to the door and sit in it where you can watch them. Watching him, and hearing the other children calling him nigger. That's what you're doing, I know. You came here just to do that, to watch him and hate him. You were here ready when he came. Maybe you brought him and left him on the step yonder yourself, but anyway, you know. And I've got to know. When he tells, I will be fired. And Charlie may... will... tell me. Tell me now." "Ah," the janitor said. "I knowed he would be there to catch you when God's time came. I knowed. I know who set him there. A sign and a damnation for bitchery." "Yes. He was right behind the curtain, as close as you are. You tell me now. I've seen your eyes when you look at him. Watched you for 5 years." "I know," he said. "I know evil. Ain't I made evil to get up and walk God's world? A walking pollution in God's own face I made it. Out of the mouths of little children. He never concealed it. You've heard them. I never told them to say it, to call him in his rightful nature by the name of his damnation. I never told them. They knowed. They was told, but it wasn't by me. I just waited on his own good time. And when he would see fitten to reveal it to his living world, and has come now. This is the sign. Wrote again in woman's sinning and bitchery. Yes. But what must I do? Tell me. wait. Like I waited. 5 years I waited for the Lord to move and show his will, and he done it. You wait too. When he's ready for it, he will show his will to them that have the say-so. Yes, the say-so. They glared at one another still, breathing quietly. The madam. When he's ready, he will reveal it to her. You mean, if the madam knows, she'll send him away? Yes, but I can't wait. No more can you hurry the Lord God. Ain't I waited 5 years? She began to beat her hands lightly together. But don't you see? This may be the Lord's way for you to tell me because you know. Maybe it's his way for you to tell me and me to tell the madam. Her mad eyes were quite calm, her mad voice patient and calm. It was only her light, unceasing hands. You'll wait, the same as I waited, he said. You have felt the weight of the Lord's remorseful hand for maybe 3 days. I have lived under it for 5 years, watching and waiting for his own good time, because my sin is greater than your sin. Though he was looking directly at her face, he didn't seem to see her at all. His eyes didn't. They looked like they were blind, wide open, ice cold, fanatical. To what I done and what I suffered to expiate it, what you done and a woman suffering ain't no more than a handful of rotten dirt. I done bore mine 5 years. Who are you to hurry Almighty God with your little woman filth? She turned at once. Well, you don't have to tell me. I know anyway. I've known it all the time that he's part nigger. She returned to the house. She didn't walk fast now, and she yawned terrifically. All I have to do is to think of some way to make the madam believe it. He won't tell her, back me up. She yawned again tremendously, her face emptied now of everything save yawning, and then emptied even of yawning. She just thought of something else. She hadn't thought of it before, but she believed that she had. Had known it all the while because it seemed so right. He would not only be removed, he would be punished for having given her terror and worry. They'll send him to the nigger orphanage, she thought. Of course. They'll have to. She didn't even go to the matron at once. She'd started there, but instead of turning toward the office door, she saw herself passing it, going on toward the stairs and mounting. It was as though she followed herself to see where she was going. In the corridor, quiet and empty now, she yawned again with utter relaxation. She entered her room and locked the door and took off her clothes and got into bed. The shades were drawn, and she lay still in the more than half dark on her back. Her eyes were closed, and her face was empty and smooth. After a while, she began to open her legs and close them slowly, feeling the sheets flow cool and smooth over them, and then flow warm and smooth again. Thinking seemed to hang suspended between the sleep, which she hadn't had now in 3 nights, and the sleep which she was about to receive. Her body opened to accept sleep as though sleep were a man. All I need to do is to make the madam believe, she thought. And then she thought, he'll look just like a pea in a pan full of coffee beans.
This ends Disc 4.
That was in the afternoon. At 9 that evening, she was undressing again when she heard the janitor come up the corridor toward her door. She couldn't know who it was. Then somehow she did know. Hearing the steady feet and then a knock at the door, which already began to open before she could spring to it. She didn't call. She sprang to the door, putting her weight against it, holding it too. "I'm undressing," she said in a thin, agonized voice, knowing who it was. He didn't answer, his weight firm and steady against the crawling door beyond the crawling gap. "You can't come in here," she cried, hardly louder than a whisper. "Don't you know that they—" Her voice was panting, fainting, and desperate. He didn't answer. She tried to halt and hold the slow inward crawling of the door. "Let me get some clothes on, and I'll come out there. Will you do that?" She spoke in that fainting whisper, her tone light, inconsequential, like that of one speaking to an unpredictable child or a maniac, soothing, cajoling. "You wait now. You hear? Will you wait now?" He didn't answer. The slow and irresistible crawling of the door didn't cease. Leaning against it, wearing nothing save her undergarment, she was like a puppet in some burlesque of rapine and despair. Leaning, down-looking, immobile, she appeared to be in deepest thought, as if the puppet in the midst of the scene had gone astray within itself. Then she turned, releasing the door, and sprang back to the bed, whipping up without looking at it a garment and whirling to face the door, clutching the garment at her breast, huddling. He'd already entered. Apparently he'd been watching her and waiting during the whole blind interval of fumbling and interminable haste. He still wore the overalls, and he now wore his hat. He didn't remove it. Again, his cold, mad, gray eyes didn't seem to see her, to look at her at all. "If the Lord himself come into the room of one of you," he said, "you'd believe he come in butchery," he said. "You told her?" The woman sat on the bed. She seemed to sink slowly back upon it, clutching the garment, watching him, her face blanched. "Told her? What will she do with him?" "Do?" She watched him, those bright still eyes that seemed not to look at her so much as to envelop her. Her mouth hung open like the mouth of an idiot. "Where will they send him to?" She didn't answer. "Don't lie to me, to the Lord God. They'll send him to the one for niggers." Her mouth closed. It was as if she'd discovered at last what he was talking about. "I've thought it out. They'll send him to the one for nigger children." She didn't answer, but she was watching him now, her eyes still a little fearful, but secret too, calculating. Now he was looking at her. His eyes seemed to contract upon her shape and being. "Answer me, Jezebel!" he shouted. "Shh, shh," she said. "Yes, they'll have to. When they find—" "Ah," he said. His gaze faded. The eyes released her and enveloped her again. Looking at them, she seemed to see herself as less than nothing in them, trivial as a twig floating upon a pool. Then his eyes became almost human. He began to look about the woman room as if he'd never seen one before. The close room, warm, littered, woman pink smelling. "Woman filth," he said, "before the face of God." He turned and went out. After a while, the woman rose. She stood for a time, clutching the garment, motionless, idiotic, staring at the empty door as if she couldn't think what to tell herself to do. Then she ran. She sprang to the door, flinging herself upon it, crashing it to and locking it, leaning against it, panting, clutching the turned key in both hands. At breakfast time the next morning, the janitor and the child were missing. No trace of them could be found. The police were notified at once. A side door was found to be unlocked, to which the janitor had a key. "It's because he knows," the dietitian told the matron.
"Knows what?"
That child, that Christmas boy, is a nigger.
"A what?"
the matron said. Back thrust in her chair, she glared at the younger woman.
"A neat. I don't believe it," she cried. "I don't believe it." "You don't have to believe it," the other said, "but he knows it. He stole him away because of it."
The matron was past 50, flabby-faced, with weak, kind, frustrated eyes.
"I don't believe it," she said.
But on the third day, she sent for the dietitian. She looked as if she hadn't slept in some time. The dietitian, on the contrary, was quite fresh, quite serene. She was still unshaken when the matron told her the news, that the man and the child had been found.
"At Little Rock," the matron said, "he tried to put the child into an orphanage there. They thought he was crazy and held him till the police came."
She looked at the younger woman.
"You told me the other day, you said, how did you know about this?"
The dietitian didn't look away.
"I didn't. I had no idea at all.
Of course, I knew it didn't mean anything when the other children called him nigger."
"Nigger?" the matron said. "The other children?" "They've been calling him nigger for years. Sometimes I think the children have a way of knowing things that grown people of your and my age don't see.
Children, and old people like him, like that old man. That's why he always sat in the door yonder while they were playing in the yard, watching that child. Maybe he found it out from hearing the other children call him nigger. But he might have known beforehand. If you remember, they came here about the same time. He hadn't been working here hardly a month before the night. That Christmas, don't you remember, when they found the baby on the doorstep?" She spoke smoothly, watching the baffled, shrinking eyes of the older woman full upon her own as though she couldn't remove them. The dietitian's eyes were bland and innocent.
"And so the other day we were talking, and he was trying to tell me something about the child. It was something he wanted to tell me, tell somebody. And finally he lost his nerve, maybe, and wouldn't tell it. And so I left him. I wasn't thinking about it at all. It had gone completely out of my mind when..."
Her voice ceased. She gazed at the matron, while into her face there came an expression of enlightenment, sudden comprehension. None could have said if it were simulated or not.
"Why, that's why it... Why, I see it all now. What happened just the day before they were gone missing? I was in the corridor, going to my room. It was the same day I happened to be talking to him, and he refused to tell me whatever it was he started to tell, when all of a sudden he came up and stopped me. I thought then it was funny, because I'd never before seen him inside the house. And he said..." He sounded crazy. He looked crazy. "I was scared. Too scared to move with him blocking the corridor. He said, 'Have you told her yet?' And I said, 'Told who? Told who what?' And then I realized he meant you.
if I had told you that he had tried to tell me something about the child. But I didn't know what he meant for me to tell you, and I wanted to scream, and then he said, "What will she do if she finds out?" And I didn't know what to say or how to get away from him, and then he said, "You don't have to tell me. I know what she'll do. She'll send him to the one for niggers." "For Negroes?" "I don't see how we failed to see it as long as we did. You can look at his face now, his eyes and hair. Of course, it's terrible. But that's where he'll have to go, I suppose." Behind her glasses, the weak, troubled eyes of the matron had a harried, jellied look, as if she were trying to force them to something beyond their physical cohesiveness. "But why did he want to take the child away?" "Well, if you want to know what I think he's crazy. If you could have seen him in the corridor that night, day, like I did. Of course, it's bad for the child to have to go to the nigger home after this, after growing up with white people. It's not his fault what he is. But it's not our fault either." She ceased, watching the matron. Behind the glasses, the older woman's eyes were still harried, weak, hopeless. Her mouth was trembling as she shaped speech with it. Her words were hopeless, too, but they were decisive enough. "We must place him. We must place him at once. What applications have we? If you'll hand me the file..." When the child wakened, he was being carried. It was pitch dark and cold. He was being carried downstairs by someone who moved with silent and infinite care. Pressed between him and one of the arms which supported him was a wad which he knew to be his clothes. He made no outcry, no sound. He knew where he was by the smell, the air of the back stairway which led down to the side door from the room in which his bed had been one among 40 others since he could remember. He knew also by smell that the person who carried him was a man. But he made no sound, lying as still and as lax as while he'd been asleep, riding high in the invisible arms, moving, descending slowly toward the side door which gave onto the playground. He didn't know who was carrying him. He didn't bother about it because he believed that he knew where he was going. Or why, that is. He didn't bother about where, either, yet. It went back 2 years to when he was 3 years old. One day there was missing from among them a girl of 12 named Alice. He'd liked her, enough to let her mother him a little, perhaps because of it. And so to him, she was as mature, almost as large in size, as the adult women who ordered his eating and washing and sleeping, with the difference that she wasn't and never would be his enemy. One night she waked him. She was telling him goodbye, but he didn't know it. He was sleepy and a little annoyed, never full awake, suffering her because she'd always tried to be good to him. He didn't know that she was crying because he didn't know that grown people cried, and by the time he learned that, memory had forgotten her. He went back into sleep while still suffering her, and in the next morning she was gone, vanished. No trace of her left, not even a garment. The very bed in which she'd slept already occupied by a new boy. He never did know where she went to. That day he listened while a few of the older girls who'd helped her prepare to leave in that same hushed secret sibilance in which a half dozen young girls helped prepare the seventh one for marriage told, still bait-breathed, about the new dress, the new shoes, the carriage which had fetched her away. He knew then that she'd gone for good, had passed beyond the iron gates and the steel fence. He seemed to see her then, grown heroic at the instant of vanishment, beyond the clash-to gates, fading without diminution of size into something nameless and splendid, like a sunset. It was more than a year before he knew that she hadn't been the first and wouldn't be the last. That there'd been more than Alice to vanish beyond the Clash Two gates in a new dress or new overalls, with a small, neat bundle, less large sometimes than a shoebox. He believed that that was what was happening to him now. He believed that he knew now how they'd all managed to depart without leaving any trace behind them. He believed that they'd been carried out, as he was being, in the dead of night. Now he could feel the door. It was quite near now. He knew to the exact number how many more invisible steps remained, to which in turn the man who carried him would lower himself with that infinite and silent care. Against his cheek he could feel the man's quiet, fast, warm breathing. Beneath him he could feel the tense and rigid arms, the wadded lump which he knew was his clothing caught up by feel in the dark. The man stopped. As he stooped, the child's feet swung down and touched the floor, his toes curling away from the iron-cold planks. The man spoke for the first time. "Stand up," he said. Then the child knew who he was. He recognized the man at once, without surprise. The surprise would have been the matron's if she'd known how well he did know the man. He didn't know the man's name, and in the 3 years since he'd been a sentient creature, they hadn't spoken 100 words. But the man was a more definite person than anyone else in his life, not excepting the girl Alice. Even at 3 years of age, the child knew that there was something between them that didn't need to be spoken. He knew that he was never on the playground for an instant that the man wasn't watching him from the chair in the furnace room door, and that the man was watching him with a profound and unflagging attention. If the child had been older, he would perhaps have thought, "He hates me and fears me, so much so that he can't let me out of his sight." With more vocabulary but no more age, he might have thought, "That's why I'm different from the others, because he's watching me all the time." He accepted it, so he wasn't surprised when he found who it was who'd taken him, sleeping, from his bed, and carried him downstairs, as standing beside the door in the cold pitch dark while the man helped him put on his clothes, he might have thought, "He hates me enough even to try to prevent something that's about to happen to me coming to pass." He dressed obediently, shivering, as swiftly as he could, the two of them fumbling at the small garments, getting them on him somehow. "Your shoes," the man said in that dying whisper. "Here." The child sat on the cold floor, putting on the shoes. The man wasn't touching him now, but the child could hear, feel, that the man was stooped too, engaged in something. "He's putting on his shoes too," he thought. The man touched him again, groping, lifting him to his feet. His shoes weren't laced. He hadn't learned to do that by himself yet. He didn't tell the man that he hadn't laced them. He made no sound at all. He just stood there, and then a bigger garment enveloped him completely. By its smell, he knew that it belonged to the man. And then he was lifted again. The door opened, in yawned. The fresh cold air rushed in, and light from the lamps along the street. He could see the lights and the blank factory walls and the tall, unsmoking chimneys against the stars. Against the streetlight, the steel fence was like a parade of starved soldiers. As they crossed the empty playground, his dangling feet swung rhythmically to the man's striding, the unlaced shoes flapping about his ankles. They reached the iron gates and passed through. They didn't have to wait long for the streetcar. If he'd been older, he would have remarked how well the man had timed himself. But he didn't wonder or notice. He just stood on the corner beside the man, in the unlaced shoes, enveloped to the heels in the man's coat, his eyes round and wide, his small face still, awake. The car came up, the row of windows, jarring to a stop and humming while they entered. It was almost empty, since the hour was past 2 o'clock. Now the man noticed the unlaced shoes and laced them, the child watching, quite still on the seat, his legs thrust straight out before him. The station was a long distance away, and he'd ridden on a streetcar before, so when they reached the station he was asleep. When he waked, it was daylight, and they'd been on the train for some time. He'd never ridden on a train before, but no one could have told it. He sat quite still, as in the streetcar, completely enveloped in the man's coat, save for his outthrust legs and his head, watching the country, hills and trees and cows and such, that he'd never seen before flowing past. When the man saw that he was awake, he produced food from a piece of newspaper. It was bread with ham between. "Here," the man said. He took the food and ate, looking out the window. He said no word. He'd shown no surprise, not even when on the third day the policeman came and got him and the man. The place where they now were was no different from the one which they'd left in the night. And the same children, with different names, the same grown people with different smells. He could see no more reason why he shouldn't have stayed there than why he should ever have left the first one. But he wasn't surprised when they came and told him again to get up and dress, neglecting to tell him why or where he was going now. Perhaps he knew that he was going back. Perhaps with his child's clairvoyance, he'd known all the while what the man hadn't, that it wouldn't, couldn't last. On the train again, he saw the same hills, the same trees, the same cows, but from another side, another direction. The policeman gave him food. It was bread with ham between, though it didn't come out of a scrap of newspaper. He noticed that, but he said nothing, perhaps thought nothing. Then he was home again. Perhaps he expected to be punished upon his return. For what crime exactly, he didn't expect to know, since he'd already learned that though children can accept adults as adults, adults can never accept children as anything but adults, too. He'd already forgot the toothpaste affair. He was now avoiding the dietitian just as a month ago he'd been putting himself in her way. He was so busy avoiding her that he had long since forgot the reason for it. Soon, he'd forgotten the trip, too, since he was never to know that there was any connection between them. Now and then he thought of it, hazily and vaguely. But that was only when he would look toward the door to the furnace room and remember the man who used to sit there and watch him, who was now gone, completely, without leaving any trace, not even the splint chair in the doorway, after the fashion of all who departed from there. Where he may have gone to, also the child didn't even think or even wonder. One evening, they came to the schoolroom and got him. It was 2 weeks before Christmas. Two of the young women, the dietitian wasn't one, took him to the bathroom and washed him and combed his damp hair and dressed him in clean overalls and fetched him to the matron's office. In the office sat a man, a stranger. And he looked at the man, and he knew before the matron even spoke. Perhaps memory knowing, beginning to remember. Perhaps even desire, since 5 is still too young to have learned enough to spare to hope. Perhaps he remembered suddenly the train ride and the food, since even memory didn't go much further back than that. "Joseph," the matron said, "how would you like to go and live with some nice people in the country?" He stood there, his ears and face red and burning with harsh soap and harsh toweling, in the stiff new overalls, listening to the stranger. He'd looked once and saw a thickish man with a close brown beard and haircut close, though not recently. Hair and beard both had a hard, vigorous quality, unsilvered, as though the pigmentation were impervious to the 40 and more years which the face revealed. The eyes were light-colored, cold. He wore a suit of hard, decent black. On his knee rested a black hat held in a blunt, clean hand, shut, even on the soft felt of the hat, into a fist. Across his vest ran a heavy silver watch chain. His thick black shoes were planted side by side. They'd been polished by hand. Even the child of 5 years looking at him knew that he didn't use tobacco himself and wouldn't tolerate it in others. But he didn't look at the man because of his eyes. He could feel the man looking at him, though, with a stare cold and intent, and yet not deliberately harsh. It was the same stare with which he might have examined a horse or a second-hand plow, convinced beforehand that he would see flaws, convinced beforehand that he would buy. His voice was deliberate, infrequent, ponderous. The voice of a man who demanded that he be listened to not so much with attention, but in silence. "And you either cannot or will not tell me anything more about his parentage?" The matron didn't look at him. Behind her glasses, her eyes apparently had jellied, for the time at least. She said immediately, almost a little too immediately, "We make no effort to ascertain their parentage. As I told you before, he was left on a doorstep here on Christmas Eve. Will be 5 years this 2 weeks. If the child's parentage is important to you, you'd better not adopt one at all." "I would not mean just that," the stranger said. His tone now was a little placative. He contrived at once to apologize without surrendering one jot of his conviction. "I would have thought to talk with Miss Atkins," this was the dietitian's name, "and since it was with her I have been in correspondence." Again the matron's voice was cold and immediate, speaking almost before his had ceased. "I can perhaps give you as much information about this or any other of our children as Miss Atkins can, since her official connection here is only with the dining room and kitchen. It just happened that in this case she was kind enough to act as secretary in our correspondence with you." "It's no matter," the stranger said. "It's no matter. I had just thought..." "Just thought what?" "We force no one to take our children, nor do we force the children to go against their wishes, if their reasons are sound ones. That is a matter for the two parties to settle between themselves. We only advise." "Aye," the stranger said. "It's no matter, as I just said to you. I've no doubt the tyke will do. He will find a good home with Miss McKeegan and me. We're not young now, and we like quiet ways, and he'll find no fancy food and no idleness, nor neither more work than will be good for him. I make no doubt that with us he will grow up to fear God and abhor idleness and vanity despite his origin." Thus, the promissory note which he'd signed with a tube of toothpaste on that afternoon 2 months ago was recalled, the yet oblivious executor of it sitting wrapped in a clean horse blanket, small, shapeless, immobile, on the seat of a light buggy jolting through the December twilight up a frozen and rutted lane. They'd driven all that day. At noon, the man had fed him, taking from beneath the seat a cardboard box containing country food cooked 3 days ago. But only now did the man speak to him. He spoke a single word, pointing up the lane with a mittened fist which clutched the whip toward a single light which shone in the dusk. "Home," he said. The child said nothing. The man looked down at him. The man was bundled, too, against the cold, squat, big, shapeless, somehow rock-like, indomitable, not so much ungentle as ruthless. "I said there's your home." Still, the child didn't answer. He'd never seen a home, so there was nothing for him to say about it. And he wasn't old enough to talk and say nothing at the same time. You will find food and shelter and the care of Christian people, the man said, and the work within your strength that will keep you out of mischief. For I will have you learn soon that the two abominations are sloth and idle thinking. The two virtues are work and the fear of God. Still, the child said nothing. He neither ever worked nor feared God. He knew less about God than about work. He'd seen work going on in the person of men with rakes and shovels about the playground 6 days each week, but God had only occurred on Sunday. And then, save for the concomitant ordeal of cleanliness, it was music that pleased the ear and words that didn't trouble the ear at all. On the whole, pleasant, even if a little tiresome. He said nothing at all. The buggy jolted on, the stout, well-kept team, eagering, homing, barning. There was one other thing which he wasn't to remember until later, when memory no longer accepted his face, accepted the surface of remembering. They were in the matron's office, he standing motionless, not looking at the stranger's eyes, which he could feel upon him, waiting for the stranger to say what his eyes were thinking. Then it came. Christmas. A heathenish name. Sacrilege. I will change that. That will be your legal right, the matron said. We're not interested in what they are called, but in how they are treated. But the stranger wasn't listening to anyone any more than he was talking to anyone. From now on, his name will be McEachern. That will be suitable, the matron said, to give him your name. He will eat my bread, and he will observe my religion, the stranger said. Why should he not bear my name? The child wasn't listening. He wasn't bothered. He didn't especially care, any more than if the man had said the day was hot when it wasn't hot. He didn't even bother to say to himself, "My name ain't McEachern, my name is Christmas." There was no need to bother about that yet. There was plenty of time. "Why not indeed?" the matron said.